Lecture number 7. This lecture is going to be a little more difficult. I have written things out rather lengthy, but I don't like now the order in which I've done it, so I'm going to have to try to go backwards, and that's doesn't coincide with what I'm done. A little more freewheeling today. One of the particular problems of the homework, which you'll be glad to know, has been postponed till next Wednesday. Problem number 3, it seems. Yp squared n was listed as p to the 6 divided by n. That's a possible problem, but it's more interesting if you make it a minus 6. Self-correction. To problem 3. Okay, the last time we were together, we were talking about our Gaussian, our normal distribution, and we had decided several things. One is that the measure mu had a support on paths which satisfied the following property. That the limit of the various points that we pull out of here, I'm being a little pedantic because of some people were absent last time. The points we pick out of the various integration variables, we sum the squares, divide by the number of terms involved, take the limit of that, and that should be 1 over b. That's where the support of this measure lives, and by golly, that means the measure depends on b. And if I take two measures of this kind, then they live with b different from b prime, then they live on totally disjoint sets called mutually singular. We want to carry that a little bit further today. And so let's raise the following question. Let's ask, instead of this particular question about it, let's ask about this question. E to the I S X P summed on P equal 1 to capital P and divided by the total number of terms. And we're going to be interested in finding out what the limit of this thing is as P goes to infinity. By the way, we did determine more precisely what this limit meant, and as you recall, it was limit in the mean, which is cutely described by putting L dot, I dot, M dot there, and this will be true here as well. So let's look at this particular quantity. We'll call that JP, just to give it a name. And we put JP into our measure, d mu b of x. Take its average first off. Well, there's only a single variable involved. That's simply the Fourier transform with parameter s of one of the degrees of freedom. So that's an e to the minus s squared divided by 2b that comes from putting this in the measure. Here I'm simply using a footnote over here, what we're using, e e to the isx e to the minus bx squared divided by 2 dx with a b over 2 pi should equal e to the minus s squared over 2b. And that's true for each of the terms in the sum identically, independent of the p. So if I sum of them, I have a factor of p multiply, I divide by that p, and that's the same. So if I take the limit here, as p goes to infinity, the answer is unchanged. So let's look at a little bit more complicated issue. The value to which this thing should converge, and we're going to square that out. It's real, so we can take it as a simple square. And then take, again, the integral of that over our measure. Now we have something strictly positive. So this will be a JP squared integral minus 2 times the cross term integral JP d mu d of x plus the square of the term itself, that's e to the minus s squared over b squared.
This b squared or b?
Bless you, it's b. Thank you for that correction. This term, again, we use our calculation up here, which was true for any p. And so that becomes exactly this term. This is minus 2, now it's plus 1, so that becomes a net 1. So this is our term to consider, minus e to the minus s squared b. Okay, what about this other guy here? Let's work above here. JP has two terms. That will be a p and a q equals 1, 2, capital P, divided by 1 over p squared. Then I have e to the isxp times e to the isxq averaged in the measure. Now, just as the same token as we did yesterday, there will be terms where p equals q in this sum, and terms when p is different from q. The terms when p equals q will be of order 1 over capital P, because there are only p terms in that sum where p equals q, but I'm dividing by p squared. So that means I will have a net order 1 over p, and as p goes to infinity, that will disappear. Then there are the terms where p is different from q. And there are fully p squared of those minus p, but as p goes to infinity, that p squared dominates over the p. So it is the only terms that will really ultimately contribute at the end. And if you're if you need a little practice on this, I urge you to look at this in more detail, is when these two guys are independent of each other, p and q. And when they are independent, then this calculation works perfectly. And so I get e to the minus s squared over this quantity squared. So I just remove the 2. This will be, strictly speaking, this will be p squared minus p divided by p squared. That's the off term. That's how many terms there are of the kind when that's off. And in the limit that p goes to infinity, this becomes e to the minus s squared over b, exactly canceling that term down here. Very similar to yesterday. In the limit as p goes to infinity. So the limit as big P goes to infinity of jp minus e to the minus s squared over 2b squared d mu of x is 0. So this time we find exactly, not only is the average equal to that, but the expression itself is equal to that.
where almost everywhere, every path we pick here of the series, of the support, I can reconstruct this piece of the characteristic function. If I expand this to second order in S, so I'm looking at the term which is S squared, that would be a 1 over 2b here. That also will be a 1 over 2 times x squared, p. And so this term already includes this particular fact. That's just the second order expansion of this term in powers of s, and it coincides with that. But this is more information. It tells you you can reconstruct this entire function. So that's, again, a support property. You had a question.
Yeah, and then we probably talked about this before, but I may have missed it. The what guarantees us that we have a non-zero support, that the size of our support, the measure of our support is non-zero?
So he asks, why do we know we have a non-zero support? Because I have, when t equals 0, for example, I have number 1 over here. If it was a zero size support, I would have 0 over here. No?
Oh.
That's my interpretation of that. Okay. Now, interestingly enough, this business can be carried a little bit further. Here I focused always on one particular variable at a time, xp. Here is the xp term here, as summed. So I'm not mixing the various degrees of freedom as I go along, but that can be done too. So this time, let's do a slightly different quantity. Similar kind of construction. E to the I, sum from n equal 1 to infinity of Sn of Xn plus P minus 1. This Y is in principle, this is like the J, this is in principle, a random variable, and for finite P it will be a perfectly good random variable. Now how does that differ? Suppose I set Sn equal to one, to S itself when n equals 1 and 0 for n bigger or equal to 2. Just choose one term and that's the sum. So if n equal 1 is the only term, n equal 1 minus 1, that kills that, and I just have a p down there, so that would be S times xp. That's exactly the case we had over here. So this is a slightly more, well, not slightly, but quite significantly more general expression than we had before. You'll notice that I have a whole family of S's here, not a single S. And a similar argument can be done. What part of the argument will I give you? Let me give you a little bit of it. Let's just look at the mean situation. But I'm going to do that in a general, not with the measure itself, but with a general extra term in that measure. Let's look at that quantity. If I had set the t is equal to 0 here, then this would have been the kind of problem we've been doing all along. I want to show you, you can get essentially the same kind of information as we've been dealing with, not by going to this square, as we have done, but by getting something straight away from the linear calculation.
Let's look at that.
Okay, so this is a 1 over p, sum little p equal 1 to cap p, integral e to the I, sum n equal 1 to infinity tn xn plus sn xn plus p minus 1 d mu b of x. So So the Tn and the Sn are kind of like each other. The Tn is married directly with the same index variable x, so if it's T1, it goes with x1. S1, however, will go with various labels here, depending on what is the value of p. For example, if p equals 1, the first term here, then it goes straight away with its neighboring x. But if p equals 2, then it goes with the next x. If p is large, then it goes with the next way down the line. Okay, we have to bear that in mind, but this is nothing more than, again, a little bit more complicated argument, but it's still based on the characteristic function associated with that measure, the Fourier transform associated with that measure. So here is the result of that evaluation. Well, by the way, remember there's no lecture Monday. Okay, so what does that thing equal to? I tell you that that's equal to 1 over p, sum little p equals 1 to capital P, e to the minus b inverse, well, let's do it this way, 1 over 2b, times sum from n equals 1 to p minus 1. Oh, that can't be right already. So let me write that down, but we'll have to correct that. Summation n equals 1 to infinity t p plus n minus 1 plus sn squared n bracket. Okay, so first, what are we trying to do? I need to get the coefficient of the same value of x because that's the one that's being integrated over. So if I took these guys up to, up to enlarge this index up to the same index, n plus p minus 1, that would be at n plus p minus 1. So that would now, these guys would then see the same variable x. That's why the Sn and these two guys come together. But this can't be correct. Because when p equals 1, that sum is empty, and that's not right. Well, could it be right? Could it be right when p equals 1? Yeah, I guess it is okay. It just means those two guys go straight away. Okay, that sum is empty when p equals 1. Yes, sir?
When we were just doing the ordinary characteristic function, you said that this that would be well defined only when sum of modulus of tn's is finite. So
we're going to also make that assumption here.
Okay.
That these double sum of is finite, so we don't run into any conflicting difficulties. Okay, so this sum is empty when p equals 1, otherwise it's alive. I expand that out up in the exponent. And you'll see that there's going to be a t squared term out of here. That t squared term begins when n equals 1. It begins when t equals p. That's the term immediately after this term. So that first term on the sum of the squares here goes all the way, n equals 1 to infinity squared. That's the contribution of this term plus the square of that term. Then there's going to be a similar term from the square of the Sn's. And there's the cross term, which is sum t, sum time 2 times n equals 1 to infinity, Sn, t of p plus n minus 1, end of exponent. Okay, what I want to argue is that as p gets larger here, as these terms p gets very large, that this thing is going to go to 0. So let's examine, in particular, sum n equals 1 to infinity, Sn, gp plus n minus 1. According to our general inequality business, we can first make that statement. Then we would use the Schwarz inequality, which says it's the sum of the Sn squareds, n equals 1 to infinity square root, times the sum of the n equal 1 to infinity of the square of these guys, t squared p plus n minus 1. And what happens when p gets large here? Since we know that tp squared n, tn n equals 1 to infinity is finite because I tell you that that is less than this sum, which you've already assumed is finite, and I square it. So that sum is finite, I square it, it's still finite. This term, when I take the cross terms, when the terms are the same, I get this one, and then there's plenty more terms in here where they cross together. So this thing is certainly finite. If this is finite, if sum of tn squared is finite, from n equals 1 to infinity, it automatically means that if I sum, say here, the first term is p equals 1 to infinity n equals p n squared, I can make this as small as I like by choosing p big enough, because this has to get small as it goes out to the end. So that means in the limit that capital P goes toward infinity, only the tail of things are important, and this cross term disappears.
John, before you leave that point, would you go back to the quadratic term in that exponent? Why doesn't the Tn have a p-dependent coefficient?
So the question is, why does the T not
the
have
a... Tn squared, sorry. Why doesn't it have a p-dependent coefficient?
This one or this one?
After you combine them in the next line.
Well, this one goes up to T p minus 1 squared, and this one starts when n equals 1, which is T p squared.
All right, gotcha, fine. Didn't understand the construction. Thank you.
Sure. Okay, so what is our conclusion from this? Our conclusion is that the limit, as p goes to infinity, this thing we call yp of x, e to the I summation tn xn, n equals 1 to infinity d mu b of x, equals... That's out of the picture, so it equals this. And what is that? First off, that is our characteristic function for the t's. That's this term right there. And the second term is exactly the same. So that is c of Sn. So putting that together, this says this is sum number times our original integral. Now I ask you, if this is true for all t, that's true for all sets of T, and that all sets of T are in a way exploring all the possible random variables that could be placed here. The only possible way for this to be true, well, I should say one more thing about this, that I can interchange the limit here, take the limit inside Y, Because YP defined here is of modulus 1. Take the modulus inside here, that's 1. Sum those P, divide by P, that's 1. The modulus of this expression is 1, and the dominated convergence theorem permits me to do that. So I take it inside, and I have the limit here. E to the I summation Tn xn, n equals 1 to infinity, d mu b. And now I tell you that this random variable is constant, behaves like a constant. Therefore, if the t's were not present, which is what we did up till now, that only tells me the average is true. But this tells me that it's true almost everywhere. In other words, y of x limit p to infinity 1 over p summation little p equals 1 to cap p e to the I, this kind of thing over here, summation n equals 1 to infinity sn xn plus p minus 1 equals a constant, which is indeed the characteristic function with probability 1. I can build the entire, listen to this very carefully, ladies and gentlemen. I can build the entire characteristic function out of almost every representative sample point in the support. If I give you all of these limits for all the sequences S, every point in the support carries the information of the entire characteristic function. It's like the cells in your body. Every cell in your body contains enough information to duplicate your body. Okay. Now, we're going to come to an analog of the Buckner theorem. You remember the Buckner theorem was what we talked about for finitely many, or particular for a single set of a single random variable, that if we had a function C of t which had the properties that C of 0 was unity, modulus C of t was less than or equal to 1, this kind of positivity condition, for every finite number of terms in the summation, and for continuity, then the C of T was indeed the Fourier transform of a probability measure. We want to find something analogous to this. This is the Buckner theorem. We want to find something analogous to that when we have infinitely many degrees of freedom. Infinitely many random variables, infinitely many integration variables. I'm going to kind of give you the answer first and then justify and explain some of the terminology. It needs something a little bit more extra than we have already on the board. So again,
what does WPO stand for again?
With probability 1. So again, everything's going backwards from my notes, so I have to reshuffle in my head. We'll be talking about the Buckner-Minlow's theorem. So we'll first state it for sequences. And then after I state this and indicate what it looks like, then we'll introduce functions in place of sequences. At the end of that, then we'll restate the Bachmann theorem for sequences. There's going to be one concept we haven't talked about that's called a nuclear space. And I'll introduce that for you after I give you the definition, then we'll go on. So, I have some functional of these uncountably many variables like we've talked about before. And it has certain properties. C, where they are all zero, should be one. C, in the general situation, is less than or equal to one in modulus. C, I can take sequences. So all of this looks very familiar. So I define the sequence this way, putting a superscript. And then continuous continuity. It's a continuous function. But there are many definitions of continuity when you go to many degrees of freedom, uncountably many degrees of freedom. And we have to qualify that for sets of T in N, a nuclear space. Then, and I'll define what that means in a minute, or at least give you an example. Then this thing is indeed a Fourier transform of a probability measure with support that's where it lives on the dual space n prime. Okay, I'll tell you about what n and what n prime mean as least of examples. Incredibly general statement. So here's an example of a nuclear space. Which we'll call N. So we're making it out of sequences, Tn. Here is a space this is a terribly cumbersome notation, the bracket Tn. I'd almost like to think of it also as a vector T, a column vector T, in the space of square summable sequences. That's a definition. That's a prescription. And we say that continuity in this space, well, in the space L2, is defined by a sequence Tj, now I'm using this notation here, goes to another sequence T, provided, this is in the sense of L2, as j goes to infinity, of course, provided that summation tjn minus the final values, tn squared, sum from n equals 1 to infinity,
goes to zero as j goes to infinity.
No surprise to that. It's no different than
what you would do in three-dimensional Euclidean space.
What do you mean by Tn equal to T? You mean convergence?
Here or here?
Up.
Yeah. Here. Say again.
Yeah, what does it mean?
This one?
No, it's the T without
derivative. T, this is just a name for this vector. Okay. I'm trying to eliminate some of the baggage to go with that. Right. What would you do in three dimensions? You'd have X and Y and Z as your variables. The length, I'll call that R, the vector. So the length of R is nothing but the square root of X squared plus Y squared plus Z squared, just the square root. That's the square of that, for example. And if I have 2 points in that space, or a sequence of points which want to go there, then I would say that's X minus XJ squared plus Y minus YJ squared. All the separate coordinates have to go to zero. The distance between the vectors has to go to zero. That's what this is. That's nothing but the distance squared here. Okay, so it's perfectly analogous. Okay, so my nuclear space is defined as follows. Going to be defined again by sequences. They're going to be many less than these fellows. One less family we've already talked about, this is a footnote, was when this was true. This is a less, T's do this, is a stronger condition than saying that. We're going to be much stronger than that. We're going to say the following. We're going to say that sum from n equal 1 to infinity, t to the n squared is finite. Oh, that's the same thing. I'm not done. When I put in n and raise it to a power r, and I say that this is finite for all r, r equals 0, 1, 2, and all integers. So that's not a single condition which does it. It's a countable conditions. It has to be true for every part.
Let's find an example.
The Tn, which is of the form e to the minus alpha n, alpha positive, I claim, will do that. For any alpha positive, that works. But, so this is okay, but a Tn of the form 1 over n to the 137 fails, because I will eventually find an r which is bigger than that 137 squared, and it's not good. So we say that the sequence Tn falls faster than any power. Because a power like this, 137 or 137 with many zeros, is still not enough to win for every r possible. False version of any power, or sometimes you say, or any polynomial. Because in this business, the polynomial will be dictated by its highest power. So that's my collection of, I'll call them test sequences. So if this is true, then that sequence is part of my space, my nuclear space. Yes, question?
Is it the only characteristic of the nuclear space? Is that the defining characteristic?
That's the defining characteristics of the nuclear space. So I have this collection of Tn's. I will also, I think I will, at least it's written down, I will call them good sequences. because there will be bad sequences. Okay. Now I have to talk about convergence. I have to talk about convergence of a sequence. PJ, in my space N,
trust me, this right now, what we're talking about right now is probably the most mathematical thing you'll see in the whole course. So get through today.
We had definition of convergence in the sense of L2, that was the rule. We're going to introduce a
different definition.
I want to talk about sequences in the space and a rule of convergence that will leave them in the space. And so what do? I take TJN minus TN, that's the coordinate differences, square it, N to power R, summation, N equals 1 to infinity, has got to go to 0 as J goes to infinity for all R equals 0, 1, 2, and so on.
Principally, we have a convergence in L2.
Oh, we absolutely will have convergence in L2. Even the first one, R equals 0, is the condition L2. And I'm asking for that plus lots more. Okay, so now we have a space of sequences, good sequences, test sequences. And we have a definition of how a sequence family will converge to another sequence in that space. That's going to be our continuity criterion. This function is continuous in that issue. So the limit as J goes to infinity of a sequence of that kind. Now this, by the way, we're going to limit this Tn to the nuclear space. And so J will be a sequence of guys in there. And we want this function to be continuous, meaning that I can interchange the function and the limit. So that's my definition of A of the nuclear space. That's now the definition of continuity. So what about the dual space here business? And what are the X's doing? So now we introduce sequences Xn, which will be bad sequences. Just a name, don't think anything terrible about it. Or generalized sequences. Right, you don't have to do that. That's not important. And how do I do that? I say every sequence, Xn, should have three constants, A plus B and C. So there exists A, B, and C such that this holds for all N equals 1, 2, 3. I bound it. We say these sequences are polynomially bounded. Just a question.
I'm sorry, I'm a little bit confused.
Louder, please, for the tape recorder.
Convergence over there, I mean, you're writing eta to a power r?
N. N is the index of summation.
I see.
That's N. The index of summation. Does that help?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so we have these polynomially bounded guys. Example. Xn equals 3 plus n 12 is okay. I can dominate by that, by the a here and n to the 12 and maybe a b coefficient to absorb that little thing. But an xn like e to the n is not good. So we have our successful t's and our failing t's. We have our successful x's and our failing x's. However, let us convince ourselves that for every, given a bad sequence, for any bad sequence, can C any good sequence, or all good sequences actually, in the sense that summation Tn Xn is well defined. Well defined means the series converges and there's no cancellation between plus and minus infinity. Well, for heaven's sakes, the Xn's can rise only polynomially, but the Tn's fall faster than any polynomial. No contest. Everybody agree? Okay, we all agree. The space Xn's of this kind, which are polynomially bounded, makes the dual space n prime. And it's called the topological dual, but we don't have to get into that because of this particular problem. So that's where the support is living. And moreover, the Tn Xn sum is always well defined. Now let's look at our example in the last minute. Our example is e to the minus summation Tn squared over 2b equal Fourier transform summation Tn Xn d mu b. Well, our example says we can live with L2 sequences. Well, maybe we back off and say L1 sequences because of what we said the last time we were together, that the Xn's might tend to grow a little bit. So this Tn is in L1 is wonderful. But if that's true, we can also restrict it even further. No harm whatsoever. We can say, we can choose another family, namely the nuclear set. They fall off really fast, faster than polynomials. And of course, we could always take sequences from here to fill this out if we cared to. But we don't care to right now. We want to observe that this function is absolutely well defined for all the Tn's in the nuclear space, and moreover, it is continuous function on that space. Therefore, Mr. Minlos said, he's the one who proved it for the infinite degrees of freedom. It's called the Bochner-Minlos because it reminds us of the Bochner theorem. He says there is a probability measure on that, for that case, and it's supported on the space of all polynomially bounded sequences. That's not wrong. It's just very generous in our case. We know that ours is supported on these kind of sequences, where the lambda n's fall off fast enough to converge. And in particular, this would be a good example, because that's a series of all positive and
this, the sum is finite. This is a case where this would catch the full support, again, generous, because we know there is this hypersphere at infinity, which also catches it, but this is generous and much less than the full space n prime. We say the support is on n prime, not wrong, a little generous, because we know it support lives on this, and clearly these are of the polynomial bounded kind.
But this is restrictive to the kind of measure we are working in, the kind of measure
Gaussian?
Yeah.
No, not at all. That had nothing to do with Gaussian. This is the absolutely general beautiful property. The property, take any C function, and you've got a probability measure associated with it. Gaussian was my working example. Yes?
Yeah, that one that you wrote, e to the minus summation dn squared over 2b.
Here?
Yeah, didn't you assume that mu is Gaussian there?
Well, this is our example. I'm talking about how does the theorem apply to our example. And what I want to say to you in particular about that is that in our example, well, n, to say that the t's are defined for n is very restrictive. I could actually go more. That's going to happen in the general situation as well, whatever Gaussian deal. And to say that the support lives on the n prime space, the whole n prime space, is not wrong because it lives on a small part of that. And that's going to be true in the very general situation as well.
In a different measure, the nuclear space and the dual space would be different.
Well, no. There are billions of examples for which this is the correct nuclear space. Now, I will grant you, and I will, when we begin next time, we'll talk about the functional form of this, which is technically a different nuclear space. Okay. Goodbye. No class Monday.